Well, it's a great pleasure to be here in order to give out the CRM Fields Prize. This prize was established 7 years ago to be one of the premier prizes in mathematics in Canada, to recognize outstanding achievement over sort of over their career. And today we have a very worthy recipient, Professor William Tutts from the University of Waterloo, who has had a very long and distinguished career. He was a undergraduate in chemistry at Cambridge, and at that time he got interested in what might seem to be a very sort of recreational mathematics kind of question, the problem of taking a square and dividing it up into a number of smaller squares where all the squares have different sizes. And he and some other undergraduates worked on this problem and found a solution. And as part of that, they came up with a method for doing computations in electrical networks, which became sort of a standard textbook technique that that students learned. Then during the war, he's well known for having worked at Bletchley Park in cryptography and a certain high-level German code codenamed FISH. And he was, you know, primarily responsible for cracking that code. Since then, you know, he went on to do a degree in mathematics at Cambridge, and since has worked in combinatorics, where he's sort of the premier figure in graph theory, and he's had a number of results named after him. Tutts matching theorem, Tutts polynomial for chromatic graphs, his theorem on characterization of regular matroids, something called the wheel theorem, which I don't know what it is. In fact, I saw two different references, one called the wheel theorem and one called it something else, a little longer, which I didn't write down, so I can't remember that. He's received many honors for his work, and we certainly are not the first to recognize it, and maybe we're not the last either. But he was elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada back in 1958, and a fellow of the Royal Society in London in 1887. He received various prizes like the Torrey Medal, which is a Royal Society medal. The Killam Prize for, which is a major prize in science in Canada for a career, that was back in 1982. And then just last week, he received the Order of Canada, became a member of the Order of Canada, and was in Ottawa to receive that shortly ago. Anyway, it's our turn. And it's my pleasure to present this certificate to Professor Tutts. Can you come up, please? Congratulations. Okay, so without further ado, I introduce Professor Tutts to give his lecture on 60 years in advance.
Well, it's a very great honor to be here and receive this prize. How am I going to find a talk that will fit the occasion? Well, my idea at first was to try to summarize my career in graph theory, talking about how one piece of research would lead on to another, and as far as I could remember, saying where various ideas for research came from. But when I came to write out the talk, I realized that there was altogether too much there, and I think I'll only be able to follow a single thread. maybe when I come to talk in Montreal, I can follow another thread. Well, when I first came into contact with graph theory, when I was at school. There was a small school library, and it contained a copy of Ralph Ball's mathematical recreations and essays. And in it I read about Euler pads, Peterson's theorem, and the four-color problem. There was even a rectangle there, dissected into unequal squares. And I was fascinated with that for a while. Of course, all this was about 70 years ago, so you may think that I've made an error in the title of the lecture. But but actually, of course, I didn't do any research at that time. I just marveled a little at what Rouse Ball was telling me. Well, I went to the University of Cambridge as an undergraduate in 1935. And there I joined the Trinity Mathematical Society. And I soon got to know, three other members of that society, Cedric Smith, Leonard Brooks, you've heard of Brooks's theorem, haven't you? And Arthur Stone. With them I had some stimulating discussions of out-of-the-way mathematical problems, and we bounced ideas off one another and actually managed to solve a few of them. And then one day Arthur Stone came upon the problem of dissecting a square into a finite number of smaller squares, all of different sizes. I've written elsewhere about how eventually we solved that problem, but I think of it now as my real introduction to graph theoretical research. For a rectangle dissected into squares, here's a very simple one. I won't make them all different. Something like that. It can be regarded as a graph, you see. The vertices of the graph are these horizontal segments, and the edges are these squares. Each square is included between two segments. It becomes an edge incident with those two vertices. We called the resulting graph, which would look like this, I suppose. Condensing each of these squares into a single segment, the p-net of the squared rectangle. P-net. P is short for polar. We call this vertex the positive pole, this one the negative pole. And we found it convenient sometimes to draw an extra edge like that. And then the p-net became a completed net, or c-net. In the cases of real interest to us, the c-nets always turned out to be three connected. They were always planar, and if you turn the rectangle through 90 degrees and made these things the vertices, instead of these, you got, of course, another p-net and another c-net. And the two c-nets turned out to be dual planar graphs. So you see, to us, a squared rectangle became a sort of textbook of graph theory. And we couldn't study these rectangles without learning a great deal of that theory. Of course, that wasn't all. To each edge of the P-net, we associated a current. An edge corresponding to this square, the current is equal in magnitude to the side of the square, and it goes from above to below with respect to the rectangle. So you have the currents in these edges of the P-net, and you find that they satisfy Kirchhoff's laws for an electrical network on the assumption that all the resistances are unity. So a lot of what we wanted could be looked up in electrical textbooks. And after discovering this, of course, we found our squared rectangles by drawing a C-net, rubbing out one edge to make a P-net, solving the Kirchhoff equations, and then translating back into this form. And usually, if we started with an unsymmetrical network, we ended up with what we called a perfect rectangle. That is, a rectangle dissected into squares, all of them of different sizes. Now, the equations for such a network can be solved in terms of the spanning trees of the P-net and the corresponding double trees. A double tree is a graph consisting of two components, each of which is a tree. So spanning trees and spanning double trees are the things you need to express the general solution of these equations. Well, we managed to work that out for ourselves, but of course then we found that Kirchhoff had done it all before in 1847. But anyway, in our full solution, or canonical solution, the current entering there was equal to the number of spanning trees of the P-net. And with that convention, all the currents turned out to be integers in the general case, and that seemed to be the right and proper canonical form. We denoted the number of spanning trees in a graph G by C of G, and we called it the complexity. Although it would be better, I think, to call it the tree number. So we became very interested in the properties of this function of graphs. The main property is a recursion formula, which is very easily proved. Suppose you have an edge A in a graph G, and when you rub out the edge A, you get a graph that I call G dashed A, and when you contract A into a single vertex, you get a graph we called G double dashed A. And the recursion formula is simply that C of G is the sum of C of the other two. These are the spanning trees of G that that do not contain A, and these are the spanning trees of G roughly that do contain A. And well, eventually we solved our problem and we found perfectly squared squares. And not long after that, the war broke out, and I was directed eventually to Bletchley Park. While they picked on me for that, I've always supposed it was because of the work on squared squares. It had got me a reputation as a solver of puzzles. Mm-hmm. Well, I came back to Cambridge after the war as a fellow of Trinity, and with the intention of spending a few years on graph theoretical research, and at the end of it writing a PhD thesis. So where to start the graph theory research? I thought of starting it with this recursion formula that I've just rubbed out. I thought, suppose I made a collection of all the graph theoretical functions that satisfied that particular recursion. C of G equals C of G dashed A plus C of G double dashed A. And I soon noticed when reading the literature that the chromatic polynomial of a graph satisfied a very similar formula. P, the number of ways of colouring G in lambda colours, equals P G dashed A lambda minus P of G double dashed A lambda. Again, very easy to prove. These colorings are the colorings of this thing with the two ends of A different colors. And this is the colorings of this thing with the ends of A the same color, essentially. Well, that's not quite the same formula. It's got a minus where the other has a plus. But if you replace this function by minus 1 to the number of vertices, pg lambda, you get back to this form. So except for a trivial multiplication, that's another function satisfying the same recursion formula. And then there was the dual of the chromatic polynomial called the flow polynomial, capital F. I think that goes like this. And it can be converted to this form by another trivial multiplication. Pardon? Oh yes, they should be F's, of course, yeah. Yeah. I introduced a few definitions then. Anything satisfying this was a W function. And if it was multiplicative, that is to say, if the function of a graph is the product of the function of functions of its components, then it was a V function. So this is a W function, but it's not a V function because it takes the value 0 for any disconnected graph. However, if you replace it by the number of subgraphs of G whose intersection with any component is a spanning tree of that component, you turn it into a proper V function. So I did have three examples of V functions there. This flow polynomial, it's the number of flows of current in a graph which satisfy Kirchhoff's current law at every vertex. And in which no current is zero, and if lambda is an integer, every current is numerically less than lambda. So, for example, if you have a divalent vertex, the current coming in is equal to the current coming out. And that suggests that for that particular function, a divalent vertex is not very important. Why not rub it out, join up the ends into a single edge, you have the same current in it, the flow is unaltered, so it makes sense to call this thing topologically invariant. If you suppress any divalent vertex, you make no real difference to the flow or the value of the flow polynomial. There's just one difficulty about that. Suppose you have a graph, the loop graph, consisting of one edge and one vertex, the edge being a loop. So you suppress the divalent vertex, and what have you left? I called it a loose edge, an edge that is incident with no vertex, and always denoted it by a little circle like this. It seemed that if you wanted to talk about topologically invariant V functions, you had to allow these loose edges. You had to allow graphs with these loose edges. Now, suppose we have a topologically invariant V function. It satisfies this recursion formula. There's a rather peculiar result that you can replace that recursion by another, and the second one applies only to cubic graphs. It is a recursion formula involving cubic graphs only. Now, this is the way it goes. Suppose you have a cubic graph, and here's a part of it. I'm just showing really one edge, and it's two ends. And these are half edges. Call them 1, 2, 3, and 4. And let that diagram stand for the function of the of that graph. And according to this thing, that is equal to what you get by deleting A, which is now like this. You had two divalent vertices there and there, and you've suppressed both. That is equal to that plus the result of contracting A, this thing. 1, 2, 3, 4. These two are cubic, of course, but this one isn't. However, you can now write another recursion like this. 1, 2, 3, 4 equals 1, 2, 3, 4 plus the same thing, 1, 2, 3, 4. And subtracting one of those equations from the other, you get something that involves cubic graphs only. Behind all this was my memory of that article in Rouse Bull that dealt with Peterson's theorem and the study of one factors of graphs. I was very anxious to try and get a V function that enumerated the one factors in cubic graphs, because the theory of one factors was only developed in those days for the cubic case. And I found that there was a recursion formula for the number of one factors. That was very like this, except for a little difference of sign. You see a one factor which contains this edge on this side of the equation is balanced by one that contains that edge there. And one that contains that edge and that edge is balanced by one here that contains that and that. One that contains this edge and this edge is balanced over here by one that contains this edge, and so on. And I think if you go through all the cases, you'll find that that's a genuine equation for the number of one factors of a cubic graph. Theoretically, you can use it to calculate the number of one factors of any graph. Theoretically, it's much too tedious in practice, of course. And to do it theoretically, you need information about this series of graphs. If you know the number of one factors of all those cubic graphs, then the recursion will theoretically take you to any other. And that's very convenient as far as it goes, because each of these has exactly one factor. All of them. But there's a first member of the series, which is the loopless graph, the loose edge graph, I mean. And there's a little puzzle about that. How many one factors has it? Well, a one factor can be defined as a spanning subgraph in which each vertex is a valency 1. And this thing has two subgraphs. One of them is itself, and the other is the null subgraph. And for each of them, it's vacuously true that each vertex has valency 1, because there are no vertices. So on those grounds, I say that this has two one factors. And now let's check the recursion in some simple cases. Start there with this edge equivalent to that one, and the formula becomes that plus that equals this plus that. Well, I think you'll agree that this has three one factors, this has two, this has one, and since each part has two, we'd better say that this has four, hadn't we? And that's arithmetically correct. Well, I'll try a few more. I think you'll find it always comes out. How do we get from a function satisfying this to one satisfying that? And I think the answer is you multiply by minus 1 to 1/2 the number of vertices. For a cubic graph, we usually say that there are 2n vertices, so half that number is simply n. So that function satisfies this recursion. And that's the recursion derived from a general topologically invariant V function. Well, is there such a general V function that reduces to this? And that was a problem that baffled me for a long, long time. In my 1947 paper, A Ringing Graph Theory, I was able to show that there actually was such a V function, a topologically invariant V function. It specializes for cubic graphs to this thing. But I wasn't able to explain it in a simple way in terms of graph theoretical structure. Just had an existence theorem, there was such a thing. Unfortunately, it was certainly not the number of one factors in the general case. But eventually, from having been baffled from 1947 to 1980, I was able to get some sort of solution and publish it in the first issue of the European Journal of Combinatorics. So that was one of my early results in graph theory, one of those I was most pleased with, although it doesn't seem to have led to anything, especially in other people's research. And another thing I did with these V functions was to put the chromatic polynomial and the flow polynomial together into a two-variable function, chi g of xy. I was very interested in that, and wrote one or two papers giving strange properties for it. And more recently, people have found applications for it, and they've given it the name of the Tuck polynomial. So that one caught on, and this one didn't. But I think I was more interested in this one, all the same. Well, this sort of specialization can be done for the chromatic polynomial too. But there you don't specialize to cubic graphs, you specialize to triangulations on the sphere, which we call planar triangulations, of course. The way we do it is take an edge A, insert it with two triangles, there's more triangulation outside, of course. And if you take A away, you get this, which is not a triangulation. And if you compress A to a single vertex, then you get this. So if you call that 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, minus, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4. And the other one goes like this. It gives you this thing again. Minus, and minus this thing. One, two, three, four. And subtracting one from the other, you get the recursion. It's minus that, isn't it? Plus that. A recursion involving planar triangulations only. And that has been much used in calculating chromatic polynomials. And of course, when people started studying chromatic polynomials seriously, they began to ask themselves, how about the zeros of these polynomials? Can we work out the real and the complex zeros and find them and discover something interesting about them all? And And I think the first result along those lines was obtained by Dickwick Hall and two co-workers who calculated the chromatic polynomial by the recursion formula of the truncated icosahedron. That's quite a complicated graph. From our point of view, we should say they calculated the chromatic polynomial of its dual, because it's the dual of that thing that is the actual triangulation. And they gave, I think it was five real zeros and a lot of complex ones. And it was noticed that one of the real zeros was very close to this, 3 plus root 5 over 2. You can call that, if you like, 1 plus tau, where tau is the golden ratio. Now, in the course of their work, which the Dickwick Hall told me took about, I think he said 15 years, they'd had to work their way through the recursion, through 900, roughly, other triangulations. And Dickwick Hall very, very kindly sent the 900 results to us at Waterloo, and Jerry Berman was very interested in them because he was studying trying to find the most efficient method of finding the zeros of a polynomial. So he practiced on these and worked out the zeros of all the 900. And lo, nearly all of them had a zero close to this, close to 1 plus tau. Well, by meditating on that for some time, I was able to get a theorem which in a way sort of explained it. The theorem says that if T is a triangulation and the number of vertices is K, then the chromatic polynomial PT, evaluated at 1 plus tau, or if you prefer tau squared, it's the same thing, take the absolute value, that is less than or equal to tau to the 5 minus k. In other words, the chromatic polynomial is very small if the number of vertices is reasonably large. That doesn't prove there's a zero nearby, but it prevents us being surprised if there is one. There's something peculiar then about that particular value tau squared of lambda. And I think what it boils down to is that there is another recursion formula independent of the first one that works for that value of lambda only. It goes like this. That plus that equals tau to the minus 3 into this one plus this one. Prove it by induction. By putting the two recursion formula together, you get a lot of surprising results for that particular value of lambda. And that's not the only peculiar value of lambda in that sense. There's a whole series of them given by this formula. Bn, Sammy Baraha was the first, I think, to point this out to us. So the B stands for Baraha, equals 2 plus 2 cos 2 pi over n. So if n equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the Baraha number comes out as 4, 0, 1, 2, tau plus 1, 3. And it goes on. And number 10 is remarkable as being tau plus 2. Well, say from here onwards, for each of the Baraha numbers, there's another recursion formula for that particular value of lambda. And it's still linear, but it's a much longer one. And as far as I know, no one has been able to get any striking theorems like those for tau plus 1 as yet. But I'm sure something will be done along those lines eventually. And these Baraha numbers are roots of monic polynomials that we combinatorialists are going to call Baraha polynomials. They're Chebyshev polynomials. They come into combinatorics with the Birkhoff-Lewis equations. That was in 1946 in a paper by Birkhoff and Lewis called Chromatic Polynomials in the Transactions of the American Mathematical Society. And that paper became practically a textbook for people interested in chromatic polynomials. These equations, I became interested in them myself, and I was able to simplify and reformulate them. And after the reformulation, they had a fairly simple matrix, and I was able to evaluate its determinant. And then a graduate student at Waterloo, Ricardo Dahab, took over, and he actually solved the equations for general n. So perhaps that particular part of the subject is closed for a while. But it's from those equations that you find the second recursion formula for all these things. Well, that's a very quick unwinding of one thread of my combinatorial life, but perhaps that's a reasonable place to end the story. So that's all I have to say today.